Jai. So, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'm going to read a little something from the Bhagavad Gita, from the chapter 13, text 34, and attempt to say a little something about the philosophy of Krishna consciousness based upon what I read. Just how many people are here for the first time again? Just okay. What I'll be reading to start off with is Sanskrit. That's the Bhagavad Gita was originally spoken in the language called Sanskrit. So I'll read the Sanskrit and then read the English translation and a brief explanation of the translation. Yata prakashyati eka kritsnam lokam imam ravi shetram shetri tata kritsnam prakasayati bharata. Translation. O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Purport. There are various theories regarding consciousness. Here in the Bhagavad Gita, the example of the sun and the sunshine is given. As the sun is situated in one place, but is illuminating the whole universe, so a particle of spirit soul, although situated in the heart of this body, is illuminating the whole body by consciousness. Thus, consciousness is the proof of the presence of the soul, as sunshine or light is the proof of the presence of the sun. When the soul is present in the body, there is consciousness all over the body, and as soon as the soul has passed from the body, there is no more consciousness. This can be easily understood by any intelligent man. Therefore, consciousness is not a product of the combinations of matter. It is the symptom of the living entity. The consciousness of the living entity, although qualitatively one with the supreme consciousness, is not supreme, because the consciousness of one particular body does not share that of another body. But the supersoul, which is situated in all bodies as the friend of the individual soul, is conscious of all bodies. That is the difference between supreme consciousness and individual consciousness. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthana Pratalaya Shimadi Bhakti Vedanta Swaminitna Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharanena Vishesha Sunyavadi Pastujari Shtana. Okay, so I brought something along with me tonight. Try to help me give this talk. And zip. Now, can anybody guess what's in this package here? Do we have any psychically talented people here? Anybody? Any guesses? What's in here? What? No. No. What? CDs? No. You're close. He's the warmest so far. What? Yeah, it's a box. Anybody? What's in the box? Anybody? Huh? No? Okay. Okay, so this is just getting... No psychics among us. Okay. Well, actually, we'll show you what's in here. Huh? No? What? Beads? No? Any final last guesses? Jack in the box? No? Any, what? Matt? No? Nobody? No, nobody's getting it. Okay. Well, yeah, it's a crossword. Oh, sorry, it's a jigsaw puzzle. And not just one, but two jigsaw puzzles. So we're going to try to use this tonight to help us make a point. Did anybody, just out of curiosity, was there anybody here who used to or still does do jigsaw puzzles? Any jigsaw puzzle people here? Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have a method? Do you have a system that you use when you do a jigsaw puzzle? I know, I used to do them. That's how I remembered, you know, came upon this idea. I used to do jigsaw puzzles before I was a devotee. And I had a way that I did it. I evolved in my, you know, sorry? That is this. Is this one method? You can start with a border. Does anybody else have any? What did you do? The corners, right. Yeah, the corner, the perimeter, right. That's definitely a more intelligent way to do it than just, say, looking at the shapes of the pieces and trying to put them together. Does anybody else have any colors. Technique? What? Bunching up some of the colors. Okay, we're getting warm here. Okay, so we're going to try to do a little something here tonight, and we'll see how it works. And I think for this next part of the class, we'll need some volunteers from the audience, okay? Uh-oh. Oh, here we go. Good. Okay, yeah. Volunteers from the audience. Now, can we have a volunteer from the audience? Okay, since you're volunteering. Okay. All right, now what? You can say it. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. Do you think... Here's two different jigsaw puzzles. They're both in their boxes here. Now, do you think that you could just, by taking a piece out and looking at other pieces, even if you had them all spread out over a table or something like that, would you be able to, you know, recognize from the shapes of the pieces, would you be able to sort of put the pieces together? It'd be very difficult, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It'd take you, if you could do it, you probably could do it, but it would take a long time, right? Okay, so we're going to suggest something different. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to, here's a piece for you, okay? Now, what I just suggested, that is one way that you could do a jigsaw puzzle. You could just start with the perimeter, put all the perimeter pieces down, because obviously you got a flat edge there. So they're easily recognizable, and you can get the whole perimeter of the puzzle like that. Then you could just look at the shapes of the pieces and try to, you know, fit the shapes together. And as this young lady just acknowledged, that would be that'd be very difficult to do that and take you a long time. There is another method, and this is the method I stumbled upon, you know, as a kid when I was doing jigsaw puzzles. It made it a lot easier and a lot more fun. All these jigsaw puzzles come with a picture on the box. There's a picture on the cover of the box. And what you do is you got your piece there? Okay. Basically, what you do is you take your piece and you look at it, right? And then you just look at the picture. And you could basically, you know, even you could sort of see where it goes in the picture. So then you have your table, you know, you're sitting at your dining room table or something like that. You have a space cleared off. And you just put it down on the table in the general sort of place where that piece would go. And, you don't have to use a magnifying glass or anything. Just from even a small little picture like that, you could do it. I actually, before I came to the class tonight, I tried it with this one, with these two, and it worked. Okay, so here's a piece, you see. Now, this piece that I just gave this young lady, now can you tell me, here's where we needed the audience participant, can you tell me which puzzle? There's two puzzles here, okay, two different puzzles, and they both have the picture on the cover. And the piece I gave her is a piece, I don't know if you could see, probably you can't see from where you are, it's a sky blue. It's just blue. Okay? So now can you tell me, can you see the pictures from where you are? Okay, they're two different scenes, and both scenes have sky in it. Okay? Now can you tell me which picture that piece goes to? Why would you say that? But doesn't it also kind of match over here, too? Look at the sky here. You got sky over there, too. But it could go there, right? It could be in there.
Okay.
Could be there, too, right? Okay, so, see, this particular... I gave her a piece of the puzzle that you really can't tell very well. It could go in either picture. This piece could fit either picture, okay? Now, I'm going to give you another one. Let me just get a good one out here. Okay. Try this one. Have a look at that and tell me which puzzle you think that, which picture that fits in. Take your time and don't get nervous. It's just, you know. This is an acquired skill here. I mean, somebody's doing it for the first time, it might take them a little bit. She'll get it. Yeah, you'll get it. You just got to look carefully. Look really carefully at the piece and then just look carefully at both the pictures and you'll see where it fits. Keep working on it. Keep working. You got it?
Yeah.
Show me. You got to show me.
Somewhere here.
No. Keep trying. Well, you're working on that one. Let me get a couple other volunteers here. We can work on a couple pieces simultaneously. Can we have another couple volunteers from the audience? I have some more pieces here. All right, just to check out this. Don't be afraid. You can. No more volunteers? This is a really fraidy cat audience. Okay, we're going to volunteer? Okay, here, have a piece. You take that piece. You can swing around there. While she's looking, you could look. And you got to try to figure out where that piece goes. Which picture? And you actually have to show me where that piece would be in either of those two pictures. Go ahead. Anybody else want to go? I got three more pieces here. Not hard. You can do it. Come on, you can do it. Buck, do you go? Try. Maybe this is harder than I thought. You got it? All right, let me see. Let's see if you got it. Okay, she got it. Let's have a big round of applause for this young lady here. She's good. Yeah, she found this a piece and it had a little part of a clock on it, and she recognized that, that must be the same as the clock on the tower here in this puzzle. And she's right. It's a fact. Okay, anybody else? Any of our other volunteers figure out where their piece goes? You want to try one? Okay. Here's a piece for you. What?
Here's a clock, too.
Okay. So where do you think it goes? Okay, Bhakti Yugo got his. He found the clock, and it, sure enough, he had a, it was also. And our first volunteer got it with a little bit of help from a friend. She saw it. Okay, so now, wasn't that easier than trying to match up the shapes of the pieces or to put this puzzle together? Anyway, that's the way you could put the whole puzzle together. You just have the picture, right? You look at the piece, and you could see where it fits in that picture. Okay? And that's how you can do the crossword puzzle. Okay, now, here's something interesting. I'm going to give you a piece right now. I'm going to give you a verbal piece right now. I'm going to throw a piece out there for everybody, and then we're going to try to put it in a puzzle. We're going to try to see what picture it fits in. No, you can go. Thank you very much for all the volunteers. Okay, that's the piece. Right. Big round of applause for all our volunteers. Thank you very much. Okay, so now here's a piece, okay? This piece comes from, I'm going to read a very short excerpt from a book that was written by a god brother of mine, and who's a resident here of New Dwarka. His name is Jutakarma Das. He wrote this very wonderful book. This is actually one of many books he's written, maybe a half a dozen or possibly even more. It's called Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. It's a very, very wonderful book. And if you haven't already read it, you should, and you can actually acquire a copy in the Govinda's gift shop, which is just above the restaurant. Very wonderful book. And you probably...
Who is that writer?
Jutakarmaprabhu. I referred to him and I didn't mention his name. Jutakarmaprabhu. And you could probably even get an autographed copy if you try hard. Or if you try. Anyway, so it's a very wonderful book. And in this book, in this one section, he quotes a section from another book that was written by... a man named F.W.H. Myers. His book was called Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death. So the subject here is out-of-body experiences. Okay. So in this book by Myers, he's put this little section here that is talking about out-of-body experiences. So here it goes. It says. Well, this was quoted in a study by another scientist whose name was Ring, who was also studying this phenomena. Okay. So it says, Ring also included in his book a case originally presented originally reported, sorry, by British psychical researcher F.W.H. Myers in his classical book, Human Personality and the Survival of Bodily Death. The subject, Dr. A.S. Wiltse, was a medical doctor. Okay, so the man was a medical doctor. In 1889, he came down with typhoid fever and almost died. As he entered a coma, he recalled feeling drowsy and then losing consciousness. Dr. S.H. Raines, the doctor who was attending Wiltse, said that for 4 hours he showed no pulse or heartbeat. No pulse or heartbeat. Okay. It was during that time that Wiltse had the following experience. Now, this is quote. This is quoting this Dr. Wiltse. It says, I came again into a state of conscious existence and discovered that I was still in the body, but the body and I had no longer any interests in common. And this is Judhakarma's comment. He says, he felt that he, the living soul, was interwoven with the bodily tissues. But then the connections with the bodily tissues began to break, and he came out of the body through the head. And now this is quoting Dr. Wiltse again. It says, I seemed to be translucent, of a bluish cast, and perfectly naked, said Wiltse. As I turned, my left elbow came in contact with the arm of one of two gentlemen who was standing at the door. To my surprise, his arm passed through mine without apparent resistance, the severed parts closing again without pain as air reunites, end quote. It says, Wiltse then gazed upon his own dead body, but then the body's eyes opened and Wiltse found himself once more inside the body and said to himself, what in the world has happened to me? Must I die again? So as he had an out-of-body experience, and then when it finished, he all of a sudden he was found himself back in his body again. So that's, you know, one experience that's described there. And then as the chapter goes on, there's another one that's described. There was this, which is even more interesting. There was this man. His name was Michael Sabom. He's a medical doctor. He's still alive, actually. He's a cardiologist. And it describes in his first year practicing as a cardiologist, he came across, I think, a coworker of his encouraged him to go to a lecture that was being given by a man named Raymond Moody, who wrote a book called Life After Life. It was a book describing people's out-of-body experiences. So he's very skeptical. He thought, this is just a lot of, you know, sentimental nonsense like that. So he went and he decided after seeing that, he says, I'm going to conduct an experiment to prove that that's not true. You know, he had access to many patients who were on the verge of death. You know, people who were on the verge of death because of being in a car crash or, you know, due to a heart attack or something like that. So he had access to them. He could talk to them. And he decided to perform a big experiment to see whether he could initially to try to attempt to disprove that this is something that really happens, or to show that there's another, explanation for it that's totally eliminates the idea that there's a conscious self or a soul separating from the body. Anyway, so, and this is his statement, to that effect. Let's see if I can find it really quickly and easily here. Oh, yeah. He says, this is his statement. He says, I would pit my experience as a trained cardiologist against the professed visual recollections of lay individuals. In so doing, I was convinced that obvious inconsistencies would appear, which would reduce these purported visual observations to no more than an educated guess on the part of the patient. So that's what he's saying. So basically what's going on is that, you know, these people, they're in an operating room. And they've had a cardiac arrest or whatever, something. And when they come back to consciousness, they report, I saw the whole thing. I was about 3-4 feet floating in the room above the body, and I saw everything that was happening. I heard everything that was being said, like that. And then they describe the details. Okay? So he was thinking, I'll catch him out, because he was familiar with all the procedures, and he had access to the medical records, you know, which are taken during, you know, when the operation is being performed. So he thought he could match him up and he would be able to show that, look, there's major inconsistencies here, there's major discrepancies. These people are, you know, saying that this is X, Y, and Z, A, B, C happen, but you know, it's probably something they just saw on television or something like that, but actually, no, it doesn't match up with what actually took place according to these records. Anyway, what happened was, it says, Judah Karma's comment says, but at the end of his study, Sabom came to a different conclusion. And the reason for that was they did match. Because he did that. He did exactly what he said he was going to do when I was just describing. And he found that the descriptions being given by these people matched the medical records. Because here's people, they're on an operating table, they have no heartbeat, they have no brain waves. You know, the chart is flat. You know, if they do the electroencephalogram or something like that, I think that's the instrument called, no brain waves. They're unconscious. They're out, cold. They're gone. You know, I mean, by medical standards, they'd be considered dead because there's, you know, no activity there, no cardio activity, no, you know, neural activity, nothing. But yet, after the whole experience, they're coming and they're describing exactly what happened, correct to the minutest detail. Even that they, some of them were even able to describe, you know, jokes in poor taste that some of the medical staff made at their expense, you know, like that. You see, so what is this? And so anyway, so as I started out by saying, here's a piece. We'll call that a piece. You know, like what's in the courtrooms, what do they say when they have a piece of evidence? Exhibit A. That's Exhibit A. Here's a piece. Okay? Now, what are we going to do with that? We'll just deal with this one piece to start off with. Or maybe that's all we'll have to deal with. Okay, so what? Here's a piece to, that's a piece to the puzzle of life, out-of-body experience. Something is being, not just, you know, being presented to us by a bunch of sentimental people from some, pre-scientific, not modern culture. No, this is something that's being investigated by people who have, you know, impeccable credentials as scientists and medical professionals, and they're presenting this. And Michael Sabom, his conclusion was that the best explanation for this was that these people were actually experiencing an out-of-body experience, you know, something other than their, you know, experiencing a genuine out-of-body experience. So, okay, so as I mentioned, there's a piece. Now, what picture of reality does that fit in? In other words, you have this piece to the puzzle of life, okay? Somebody, many, many people experiencing themselves being out of their body and observing their body from a point outside. What picture of reality does that fit into? Okay, let's call this, just like we did in our little experiment, you know, right at the beginning of the class, we had the two pictures, okay? And I gave our volunteers a piece, and I said, okay, volunteers, which picture does your piece fit into? And they were able to correctly identify, well, the piece, there was one, the first piece I gave the young lady, she said she couldn't tell, really, because it was blue sky. And there's blue sky in both the pictures, you see? So it was difficult to distinguish. She really couldn't distinguish. So in some areas, okay, you know, there are things like that. There are certain pieces of the puzzle of life which are kind of neutral. I'll give an example of that. Let's take health, okay? Okay, so modern medical science says if you eat simple foods and exercise regularly, it's good for your health. And also, the Vedic worldview, the Krishna, you know, Krishna consciousness says, if you eat simple foods and exercise regularly, it's good for your health. And if anybody does that, you'll find, yeah, it's true. If you eat simply and, you know, don't overeat and you exercise regularly, you'll feel improvement in your health, or you'll maintain good health. But, so the point is that is a neutral piece. That, because why? Because it verifies both pictures, assuming that this is the picture we get from science, and this is the picture we get from Krishna consciousness. Okay, that particular thing verifies both pictures of reality. Okay, but let's take, but then we, so that was like, that piece is like the blue sky, you know, the health. It's like the blue sky piece. But then when we gave our volunteers a different piece, you know, that was much, much more detailed than everything, they could see that, well, it clearly didn't fit into one picture, and it did fit into the other picture. Okay? So in that way, we could tell that this, you know, in terms of those pieces, there's a little piece with a little piece of a clock on it, Well, this picture doesn't even have a clock on it, whereas this one had a clock, you know, big on the tower. So we know for sure that here's the picture, here's the piece with a little picture on it, and here's the main picture. It fit into this picture. Therefore, this is the picture. Okay? It doesn't go in this picture. So in the same way, it's an analogy. Okay. So here we have something like out-of-body experience. Okay? Which picture does that fit in? Assuming that this is a fact, that it's something that's, you know, really happening, that it's not just, you know, like somebody's, you know, an interpretation that's not correct, okay, that's just illusory or something. Assuming that this is actually, you know, correct and that there is such a thing as out-of-body experience, which picture of reality does it fit into? Does it fit into the picture of reality that we get from modern science? Okay, no. It doesn't. It doesn't. And here is a very brief description of a statement by Judah Karma about where modern science is about consciousness. He says, those who hold that mind and consciousness are produced as an emergent, as emergent properties from matter in the neuronal circuitry of the brain are faced with major difficulties. They have not been able to explain in any detailed and convincing way how molecules interacting with each other according to known physical laws produce consciousness. So that's very simple, one sentence, but that sums it up. Modern science has not been able to explain in any detailed and convincing way how molecules interacting with each other according to known physical laws produce consciousness. Because that's basically what they say. That's their assertion. Their assertion is that consciousness is just something that's generated by neural impulses. You know, it comes about when the brain reaches a particular stage of biological maturity and organization, you know, then you have consciousness. But they can't back it up. They can't say by, you know, what's the mechanism. They can't actually describe or explain exactly how it's happening. It's just an assertion. Okay? So basically, and the point is that means when the brain stops working, right, that's the end of consciousness. That's the implication, right? Before the brain's working, there shouldn't be any consciousness. And certainly when the brain stops working, that's the end of consciousness. If consciousness is produced by the brain, when there's no more functioning working brain, no more consciousness, right? Logically, obviously, okay. But what do we see is happening? What we see is happening is that here's a person, you know, like it's described in that little, you know, scenario we described. No brain waves, no heartbeat, nothing. You know, totally out, and the consciousness continued. The consciousness was still there. So now, does that fit into the science, the picture of reality we get from science? No. Everybody agrees with that? There's no way you can fit that into the picture of reality we get from science. Does it fit into the picture of reality we get from Krishna consciousness? Yes, it does. Very easily, very simply, and very neatly. As a matter of fact, that's why I chose that verse tonight, where Krishna is saying, O son of Bharata, that's Arjuna, that's another name for Arjuna, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. So in other words, the consciousness, just like light is coming from the sun, you know, the shine, you don't have shine unless you have sun, it's because it's sunshine. So in the same way, consciousness is coming from the soul. No soul, no consciousness. Right? But because the soul is there, the consciousness is there. So in other words, this whole idea of a conscious self that's separate from the body, that's, you know, like a very basic element of the whole of worldview, of the Vedic worldview. So the point I'm trying to make is like, this is, by process of elimination, you know, we can see how Krishna consciousness is giving us Krishna consciousness is the, gives us the picture of reality that, it provides the picture of reality that all the pieces of the puzzle of life fit into. You could do it like that. Now, I'm going to say something. This is not the standard way. This is not the standard Vedic procedure for, you know, establishing that Krishna consciousness is the absolute truth. But it's interesting. Yeah? I'll say that statement again. So Krishna consciousness provides the picture of reality that all the puzzles of the picture of life fit into. You could take anything, any phenomena, okay? which we won't do because you know don't have a lot of time. But like say, for instance, children remembering their past lives. I'll just throw that one out there, just without getting into it in detail. There are children, not many, but there are. You know, I mean, when I say not many, I mean not many in terms of the number of children that are on the whole planet, because there's billions probably, or at least hundreds of millions. But there are, you know, at least been a few thousand cases studied of young children who, when at the age of 2 or 3 years old, when they first start speaking, have a memory of who they were in their past life. These are young kids. They haven't been able to go on the internet and, you know, or watch TV or anything. Like, they're just starting to talk. And they start coming up with all this information about who they were in their past life. In this book by Judah Karma, there's one interesting, there's many interesting ones that are described where they take this there was this young girl, she claimed to be a certain person in a previous life, so they had her, she led the way to the home where she used to live. She was able to identify and notice that there were certain things different about the house, but then she proceeded to identify her former husband, her former father-in-law, mother-in-law, the husband's two younger brothers, her daughter from the previous lifetime, etc. You know, all these different things. She made all these correct identifications without it making any mistake. And even somebody came in, somebody tried to trick her in some way, and they weren't able to do that. And that's one case of 2,600 cases that this one particular man, his name's Ian Stevenson, devoted 40 years of his life to doing this type of research. So this is another example of that. You know, another piece. It's a piece in this puzzle of life. Young children remembering their past lives. And, you know, a man, by the way, this man, Ian Stevenson, is also has impeccable credentials. He started off as a medical doctor. He was practicing in Canada. And then he became the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. And then during that time, he did this study. It's about 40 years of his life studying this phenomenon, these young children remembering their past lives. So is it explained by modern science? No. As far as modern science is concerned, they're silent. Why? Because they can't. It doesn't fit into their picture of reality. They can't be. How could there be a child remembering a previous lifetime? Because there's nothing. When somebody dies, that's the end. But full stop. There's no. How does a memory transfer from one life to the next time, to another life? It's not possible, according to the picture of reality given from modern science. We're just a bunch of atoms. You know, or molecules, and when you're dead, that's the end of everything. It's all over. Right? So, but does it fit into the picture of reality we get from Krishna consciousness? Yeah, no brainer. Dehi no smin yata dehe komanam yovanam jara tata dehantara praptir diras tataramuyate. Krishna says in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says, calls this the beginning, you know, the ABC of Krishna consciousness. As the embodied soul continually passes in this lifetime from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes on to another body at the time of death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. There's so many verses. That's just one verse. There's like probably dozens of verses similar to that throughout the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, throughout the Vedic literatures, talking about reincarnation. How the soul, at the time of death, goes on to another body. The body you get in your next lifetime is determined by the quality of your activities during this lifetime. But the point being that, yeah, it's right there. It fits, no problem. It fits into the Krishna conscious picture of reality. Once again, these different pieces, you know, these things which science has to kind of, you know, brush under the carpet, so to speak, because they're anomalous. They can't explain them. You take those same things and you hold them up and you try to see, well, can I find a place in the Krishna conscious picture where they fit in? And no problem. Just like these, our volunteers had no problem, more or less, putting their piece and finding which picture it belonged to. So, like this, you see, there's so many different things you could do. And his whole book, Judah Karma wrote this book as a follow-up for another book called Forbidden Archaeology, in which he showed, using the fossil record, that anatomically modern human beings have been around, not just like, you know, a few thousand or tens or thousands of years, but millions and even hundreds of millions of years. He showed from the very same records that the scientists were using to show that anatomically modern human beings are something of the last 10,000 years or less. He used those same fossil records, you know, digging up different reports which had been sort of swept under the carpet or discredited or criticized in different ways. He brought those same reports forward, and he showed that these reports, the quality of these reports were just as good as the other reports, and therefore there's just as much evidence to support the idea that anatomically modern human beings have been around for hundreds and thousands and millions of years as there is to support this recent idea. Once again, you see, so now does that fit into the scientific worldview? No, because science is telling us that human beings like us, civilized human beings, have only been around 10,000 years or less. What does Krishna consciousness tell us? Something totally different. You see? So once again, the scientific worldview can't accommodate that evidence, but can Krishna conscious worldview? Yeah, here, let's give an example of it, okay? Can the Krishna conscious, just off the top of my head, because this is the easiest example I can come forward with. Right here in the beginning of the fourth chapter. Krishna says, Imam vivasvate yogam, proktavam aham aviyam, vivaswan manave praha, manor ikshvakave bravit. This is Krishna speaking. He says, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god Vivaswan. Okay, so this Vivaswan is a demigod. He's the predominating deity of the sun planet. Okay? So it says, Vivaswan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind. Okay, Manu is also a demigod, not residing here on earth. Okay? And then it goes, but Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku was an earthly king. Okay? And Prabhupada explains in the purport that, let's see if I can find the exact sentence here real quick. He goes, Prabhupada says, Accepting that before the birth of Manu, the Gita was spoken by the Lord to his disciple, the sun god Vivaswan, a rough estimate is that the Gita was spoken at least 120,400,000 years ago. And in human society, here it comes, Bhagavad Gita, and in human society, it has been existent for 2 million years. See? So in other words, once again, according to the Krishna conscious worldview, I mean, we're not saying that that's all that human society has been here on earth. But just even the Bhagavad Gita, according to this analysis of this statement by Krishna, has been around for 2 million years. So that means Ikshvaku was a king, earthly king, who was living on earth 2 million years ago. So, you know, once again, you know, easily accommodated by the Krishna conscious worldview. So anyway, the basic point I'm making is that, as I said, Krishna consciousness provides the picture of reality that all the pieces of the puzzle of life fit into. And if you examine other pictures of reality, it doesn't do that. The predominant picture of reality that can sort of competes, at least in some people's minds, with the Krishna conscious picture of reality is the scientific picture of reality. But it doesn't, as we could see from these just few examples like that, it doesn't, you know, it can't compete. It doesn't really, because it doesn't explain these things, which are, assuming that these are real things that are happening, it doesn't have any, offer any explanation for them whatsoever. Then there's, of course, there's other worldviews, the Christian worldview, or the Muslim worldview, or this, you know, but they also don't. They also come short. Like, I just, off the top of my head, to give you a Christian, let's say the Christian worldview. Well, it says in the Bible, it's appointed for man to die once, then the judgment. So as far as assuming that these kids are really remembering a past life, that can't be accommodated by the Christian worldview, because as far as Christians are concerned, at least according to their theology of the Bible, there is no such thing as reincarnation. You know? Consciousness, you come into existence when you're born. There's no pre-existence of the soul. You come into existence when you're born, you live, and then when you die, you're judged, and you either go to heaven or hell. There's no reincarnation. See, so assuming that this is, it's really, you know, these kids are really remembering a past life, then, well, once again, it's not supported by the Christian worldview. Just to give you like a bit of an example like that. So, as I mentioned though, this is not the actual method that we use to establish that Krishna consciousness is the absolute truth. Actually, that is mentioned, the actual, standard method of why we accept Krishna consciousness as the, absolute truth is mentioned in the next verse of that same chapter I just quoted, fourth chapter Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo vidu sakaleneha mahata yoga nashta parantapa. Says the supreme science, this is Krishna speaking again, he says the supreme science was thus received through the chain of the cyclic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. That's the reason. We accept Krishna consciousness as the absolute truth because it's coming down in an unbroken chain of teachers that are all liberated souls. They're all, you know, perfectly spiritually enlightened people, and they're just repeating the knowledge that they received from their perfectly enlightened spiritual master, who back until when you go back far enough, it was initiated by Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's the, you know, the formal or the official way, reason why we accept Krishna consciousness or this philosophy as being perfect, absolute truth, because it's coming down in an unbroken chain of perfectly self-real, spiritually enlightened people that can be traced back to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now somebody might, but see, the reason, and this is the reason why I'm giving this whole class, okay? Now back, if you were to turn back the clock, and take yourself and turn, you'd have to turn back the clock and also do a little bit of a, you know, transport and take us all back to India, transfer us to India and turn back the clock, say 5,000 years ago or 6,000-7,000 years ago, and I read this to an audience of people there, no problem. That would be an easy thing for people to accept. You see, because back in India, in the Vedic culture, you know, in a time when before science and before, you know, when this worldview was actually the dominant worldview, people had a relatively easy time accepting that. Oh yeah, that we should accept this knowledge because it's coming from a bona fide spiritual master, you know, somebody who's spiritually enlightened, and they received it from their enlightened spiritual master who received it from his enlightened spiritual master. That would be, everybody would be comfortable with that. But are we comfortable, turn forward the clock 5,000 years and take us back here to Los Angeles or any major city here in the United States or any place in the Western world for that matter, are people comfortable with that? No, they're not. Everybody, as far as the average American or average Western educated person is concerned, they're not comfortable with that. To them, that's just dogmatic. The average response to that, you know, that's way of receiving knowledge is that, no, well, I mean, I have to accept that because you say so. It means just because you're the authority and you're saying so, and I have to accept. People don't like that. They're not comfortable with that. They want they want hard evidence. You know, they want hard evidence. They want to be able to verify in some way. Okay, so that brings us to tonight's class. This was my own humble attempt to show that the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is externally verifiable. It's verifiable. In other words, you have the philosophy, the picture of reality that we receive from Krishna consciousness. And then you can examine different phenomena, and you can see that those phenomena are accommodated within that worldview, and they cannot be explained by the worldview of modern science or Christianity or this or that or the other thing. But they're very easily and clearly, very clearly and easily explained with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. That's one point, and that's why tonight's class. Another point is another way. There's another type of verification too. There's external verification, and that's what tonight's class was all about. But there is also Krishna consciousness is internally verifiable. In other words, this is not a matter of faith. You know, accepting that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If some people think that, oh, that's just your belief, that's just your faith. Well, it is, but we have good reason for it. It's externally verifiable. And here, in this verse, very nice verse from Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami was one of the principal followers of Lord Chaitanya, who was the devotional incarnation of Krishna that was here just 500 years ago. So he wrote a book called the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which Srila Prabhupada has translated the title meaning the nectar of devotion. So in that verse, in that book, he describes the process of Krishna consciousness. And this is and what you're about to hear now is the process which describes how Krishna consciousness is internally verifiable. This is not just a matter of accepting it on faith. It's not like becoming a devotee means that you come to the temple, you hear all these far out ideas, you know, and you just, for the whole rest of your life, you just have to go, well, yeah, I believe that because, well, it says so. They told me it says so in the book. It says so in the Bhagavad Gita or Prabhupada said. No, you can experience for yourself how this is the truth. Here's the internal verification. This is described by Rupa Goswami. He says, in the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. Okay, now, here it comes. Here's the internal verification. Okay? If you do everything what you've just heard so far, those four or five steps that I've just read so far, this is what's going to happen. It says, by execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment. First thing. Attains steadiness in self-realization. Second thing that happens. Acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Says this taste leads one further to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. End quote. See? So that's what happens. So it knows if we're really, if we're sincere and we're serious, if we really take up the, with the, you know, this process fully, you know, with enthusiasm and sincerity and the way Prabhupada is instructed, that's what we're going to experience. And then when you experience that, you know, then you know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, then you know, this is the absolute truth. There's nothing, there's nobody that can tell you any different. Because you know it. It's just like Prabhupada would give the example, just like when a hungry person is given a nice plate of nutritious edibles and he starts eating. Okay? What happens? He feels, he feels like relief. Oh, what a relief. I was starving and now I'm eating this and what a relief. Now I can feel how I'm getting some strength. He gets some strength. Okay? What else happens? It tastes good. He's enjoying the taste. Right? What else? Christy? There's three things, but I can't remember the third one. Yes, thank you. And he feels satisfied. He keeps eating, and meantime, all the weakness is going away, and he's enjoying the taste, and then after like, you know, 10, 15 minutes of eating, he feels like, oh, okay, that's it. That's enough. I'm fully satisfied. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a line, Pratyak Shavagamam Dharmyam. It gives direct perception of the self by realization. See, so it's not a matter of just faith. You just like the person in that example, then the person who's hungry, if he gets some real nutritious edibles and he eats it, he feels the weakness go away, he enjoys the taste, and then he feels fully satisfied. So in the same way, if we engage nicely in this process of Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada meant for us to take it seriously. And if we do, we experience these things. We'll experience becoming freedom from material attachment, steadiness and self-realization, acquiring a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of God, etc. Maturing and eventually bhava and then prema. Bhava is ecstatic love for Krishna, and prema means pure love for Krishna. So it's, in that sense, it's internally verifiable. So Krishna consciousness is, we got it from all different angles, you know. We accept it because it's coming down from an unbroken chain of perfectly self-realized spiritual masters. We're accepting it because you take anything in life, and you're going to be able to find that the philosophy of Krishna consciousness can perfectly explain that phenomena. And if we're fortunate, and we seriously and sincerely engage in the process of devotional service ourselves, we'll get this pratyak shavagamam damyam, direct perception of the self by realization. We'll directly experience how these things that we hear. We'll directly experience how we're not this material body, how we actually are eternal spiritual beings, how we're the eternal servants of Krishna. When we chant Hare Krishna, you'll feel enlivened. You'll feel blissful. And actually, in Lord Chaitanya, who's, you know, as I mentioned, was the devotional incarnation of Krishna, he only left eight prayers in writing. That was the only written contribution of Lord Chaitanya. The first one goes Chaito Darpana Marjanam Bhava Maha Devagani Nirvapanam Shreya Kairava Chandrikavana let's try it again. Chaito Dharpana Marjanam Bhava Maha Devagani Navapanam Shreya Kairava Chandrikavataranam Vidyavadu Jivanam Anandam Buddhivardhanam Patipadam Punamitasvardhanam Sarvatma Snapanam Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtan. Translation for that is, this is Lord Chaitanya speaking, he says, glories to the Sri Krishna Sankirtan. Sankirtan means congregational chanting of the holy names of God, which cleanses the heart of all the dust accumulated for years together. Same thing. That means you become free from attachment, material attachment. Your heart becomes cleansed of all the material desires. That's what's meant by the dust of all, you know, dust accumulated for years together. Okay, so it cleanses the heart of all the dust accumulated for years together. And in this way extinguishes the fire of conditioned life, of repeated birth and death. You become liberated. You know, this becomes your last life in this material world. You know, this is the initial installments of the benefit of chanting Hare Krishna. When you start chanting sincerely, you become become purified enough so that at the end of this lifetime, you won't be forced. You know, you won't be obliged to take birth again in the material world, in the material body. You'll become liberated and go back to Godhead. Okay, so that extinguishes the fire of conditioned life, of repeated birth and death. Vidyavada Jivanam, it's the life of all transcendental knowledge. this philosophy becomes alive. It becomes not just, as I said, just intellectual, just a bunch of ideas. It becomes, you realize it. You just know it's true. And then he goes on to say, Vijayavada Jivanam, Anandam Buddhi Bardhanam. You experience transcendental bliss and ecstasy while you're chanting. And Vijayavada Jivanam, Anandam Buddhi Bardhanam, Patipanam Putamina Svadhanam. It gives you a full taste. You feel fully satisfied. And you realize that there's nothing beyond this. So the same point again, that you know, just by engaging in this process, we directly experience. We have to be patient. One last point, and then I'll stop. Rupa Goswami, same author, in another literature, he gave us a book called Upadeshamrita. Prabhupada translated that as the Nectar of Instruction. And he explains that there are certain things we have to do in order to be successful in devotional service. He said, Utsahan nishchayat taryat tat tat karma pavartanat. I can't remember the third line, but the fourth line is subdhir bhaktir pranashyati. That utsahan, enthusiastic. And as he's saying, there's certain things we have to do in order to be successful. We have to be enthusiastic. We have to be determined. We have to be patient. So in other words, it's a very serious. It's a serious thing. We have to practice devotional service, not casually, not haphazardly, but you know, like do it like it's the thing, the most important thing you've ever done in your life. Doing it as seriously as you would do anything that you've ever done. And if we do it like that, then Krishna becomes pleased. Krishna's within our heart. In the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Tesham satatayuktanam bhajatam pritipurvakam didami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite tesham eva anukampartam aham agyanajam tamaha nasyami atmabhavishto jnana dipena bhashvataha. Krishna says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Out of compassion for them, I, dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. That's how it works. That's the last thing. That's the last point, and that's how it works. Krishna is within our heart, and He can understand how sincerely we're trying. And if we really try sincerely, you know, according to the different rules and regulations, then Krishna is within our heart. He's aware of that, and He will reciprocate. He rewards us. And what is that reward? Nasyami atma bhavishto. He destroys with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Notice Krishna enlightens us. He'll enlighten us from within. And all these things will be revealed to us. We'll understand that we'll directly be experiencing how this is the absolute truth. Okay, anyway, thank you very much for being such a patient and attentive audience. Okay. So, does anybody have any questions? Or would anybody like to come up here and try to put a few pieces in the puzzle here? Or? Yeah. Okay.
You very nicely explained that Krishna consciousness, the higher science, and the material science.
Yeah, thank you. I was trying to do that. Thank you. I'm glad somebody felt like I did it. I succeeded. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Yeah. Sure, come on.